American familiar with the reservation system, where the Indians were forced onto the reservations. Well, this was officially a governmental policy, and it was seen as very sort of progressive and high-minded at the time. Resolving the Indian problem is the way it was spoken about at the time, the Indian problem. And, of course, this Indian problem is not new to us. We've been dealing with Indians and appropriating their land and taking from them what belonged to them since the first English settlers arrived in what is North America. But the Plains Indians are somewhat unique in that their lifestyle was nomadic or semi-nomadic, and people tended to have less regard for the human rights of nomadic people because they're not settled, they don't depend on agriculture, and their right to the land is considered to be more tenuous generally. Of course, this is the logic that people that were looking for pretext to take their land used. So the Sioux Indians, for example, were nomadic. They followed the herds of
buffalo
across the Great Plains. And so to white Western eyes, it looked like they were not really fixed in any particular place, which was a problem because for the progress, quotation fingers, of westward expansion to take place, these semi-nomadic indigenous peoples had to be removed. They were considered to be a barrier, an obstacle to America's westward expansion and development and growth and to our civilization, because most people consider that the Plains Indians were not really, it wasn't possible really to incorporate them fully into white society. And efforts like that had been made with the Eastern Indians for years, efforts to try and acculturate and Americanize.
Assimilation, the Dawes Act.
That's a perfect, yeah, the Dawes Act was an effort. And they tried, but for the most part, you know, the Plains Indians problem was far removed from the centers of power. People back east didn't really fully understand it. It had been hundreds of years since we'd seen an Indian back east. So the concept was, you know, all we knew is there were these savage Indians on the frontier that weren't really assimilatable, and that they were more primitive than perhaps the Native American peoples that we had encountered in the East. That was what people generally understood. They weren't Christian, they were savage, they were uncivilized, they were primitive, semi-nomadic. They didn't really improve the land to the understanding of white Americans because they were semi-nomadic. They depended on grazing animals. So they didn't have much valid claim on the land. But they were an obstacle. So the solutions were the reservation system. And then subsequently, that became a problem because once we filled up the West, some of these reservations were quite large, several hundred, in some cases several thousand square miles. Well, even those lands became valuable to Western ranchers and miners and farmers because it was understood that there might be something of value in those lands. So this would be the case up in Montana in the Powder River Country and in the Black Hills in the Dakotas where they believed there was gold and they, you know, mistakenly allowed that as Sioux land. It remained Sioux land until white settlers, ranchers, and farmers decided that there was something valuable in it. Well, anyway, the army, when they did it, they reversed the psychology of how these people had come to live and interact with their environment, and they'd forced them into relatively small reservations. And usually in order to do that, they'd have to drive them to ground using the power of the U.S. military anyway. They would get chiefs to sign treaties, which they had done this back east. And generally speaking, the way that Indian civilizations and communities operated is that there would be a group of elders, often, not necessarily all of them particularly old, but elders, men, in some cases women played these roles in the Plains tribes. And they would make decisions collectively. And there would be one chief that they usually called the war chief, and there'd be another one that was like a peace chief.
Like Sitting Bull was one of them?
Well, Sitting Bull was variously considered both. But they didn't have like one principal chief in whom all executive power was vested. That was not typically the way they did it. And so when the army wanted to make a treaty, they would go to the peace chief. And they would ignore or try and bribe and buy off, and they would do it all. They'd bribe them off with weapons, with ponies, with favorable terms in the reservation, proximity to the agency, all this business. So these Indians, these Native Americans were fairly sophisticated after they had dealt with the army for a while. And so you made a treaty with the most peaceful band, and then the war chief and the young men generally were like, well, you know, we're Cheyenne warriors. We don't live on a reservation and take rations from a federal government reservation agency. The rations were usually of beef that were purchased on contract by the War Department, by the Army Bureau of Indian Affairs, which was notoriously corrupt. The quality of the of the food. A lot of times in the treaties, they were told, if you will go and stay on this reservation, the government promises to provide you with this many head of beef, this many blankets, this much medicine. And there was no real assurance to make sure that that end of the bargain was met, and often it wasn't. So by the time the supplies reached this reservation, way out in the middle of the Dakotas, the quality was inferior, the number wasn't there, and the Indians would get restless because they were hungry. And the young men were like, well, why can't we just hunt and sustain ourselves in the traditional way and go hunt the buffalo? Well, because that would mean going renegade, leaving the reservation. So this cycle happens over and over and over all over the West. The young men are humiliated. The Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Army folks at the post, at the agency, were kind of watching over them, and they were trying to instruct them on how to farm. And this is insulting to Plains Indians men, because that was women's work. Hunting was men's, warriors was men's. Women did gathering, agriculture-type stuff, and they were told, well, this is what men do. That's what white men do, right? They stay on one plot of land and they farm wheat. The Indians were like, we're not doing that. You know, we'd rather die with our moccasins on. And so the young men often would ride off, and the army would go chasing after them, and because they had left the reservation, they were considered a legitimate renegade band, and they were pursued, and they were wiped out. Or they would escape into Canada, which is what Sitting Bull did. Sitting Bull took his band of Minneconjou Sioux and escaped into Canada for several years before coming back, because he was present at Little Bighorn. And then he gradually comes, you know, he comes back, and eventually he ends up in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. He became sort of a celebrity, and ultimately he's murdered under mysterious circumstances.
I thought Sitting Bull, before the battle of like Little Bighorn, he did like the Sundance thing, and he like cut himself up.
A lot of people did Sundance, and Sundance had been around for a while, but the Ghost Dance movement was big by that point as well. And so those two are like spiritual practices that are probably related. But Sundance was typically like a younger man's vision quest, whereas the Ghost Dance was kind of a pervasive culture-wide. And they would meet together, large groups would meet together for powwows, where they would dance for days and days. People would dance to the point of exhaustion, delirium. They'd have mystical trances, visions, and they had sacred garments that were painted white, and they had pictures of like, they had spiritual symbols that were painted on the garment.